I remember as a kid living for the weekend. You endure 40 hours of school all week for Friday. And on Friday you get to relax. You get to go home. You get to not have to worry about school for three more days. And I remember all of my friends and me talking about that and anxiously awaiting the weekend as Friday would approach. And they would have all kind of big plans ready. They would have sleepovers, and they were going to play video games, and they were going to listen to music and watch movies and all that kind of stuff. And then there was my mom's Friday night version of Friday Night Fun. Now, we too would play games, Bible trivia, and we too would watch movies, the Ten Commandments, and we too would listen to music, and we would even sing church songs. I don't remember any movies that I watched growing up on those fun Friday nights, but I tell you what did stick with me was a love and an understanding and a knowledge of the Old Testament that my mom infused within me and my brothers whenever I was a young man. And I tell you, I appreciate that sacrifice and that work and the effort that she made in helping and instilling that in me and in them, because that's applicable. That's useful to me now. So this morning, I'd like to start off with just a little bit of Bible trivia. Perhaps you played that game, but at the very least, you know how it works. You ask someone a question or you describe for them something, and they try to determine what it is from the Bible you're talking about. So we're going to be studying this morning about a person. And I'm going to describe that person to you, and I want you to try to identify who it is I'm describing. We're talking about a man this morning who was a young Israelite. His life was a reflection of what it meant to love and to serve and to trust in God. We're talking about a special man that wasn't afraid to step out into the unknown when others would not, because he didn't trust in his own ability or his own talent, but he trusted in a true and living God. We're talking about a man who was courageous on the battlefield, who at one point in time changed the tides of war when Israel was battling their enemy. We're talking about a man that had a great respect for God's plan. We're talking about a man whose story can be found in the book of 1 Samuel, a man after God's own heart. Now I want you to think for just a moment, who might I be describing? If you said David, you're close, but you're wrong. As I read the story of Jonathan in the book of 1 Samuel, one of the things that quickly came to my understanding was that Jonathan was a man that was cut from the same cloth as David was. And as we read David's stories, there's many things about David's life that are wonderful for us that we can take away and follow in his example, because he was faithful to God in so many areas of his life. We can also learn from some mistakes that David made. But as I read Jonathan's story in the book of 1 Samuel, what I found out this morning was that not only was David was not the only man after God's own heart, as I read about Jonathan, what I saw was another man after God's own heart. So I'd like to spend some time this morning considering this man. Before we delve into our study, there are some things that you would know to be brought up to speed that will help you understand and appreciate our study better this morning. The period of the judges in the book of 1 Samuel has come to an end. They've asked for a king, and God has provided them with a king by the name of Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. Jonathan is Saul's oldest son. He's the one, normally the way things would go, the king would pass down his crown to his son. Jonathan was the crown prince. After his father died, he would be the one that would sit on the throne in Israel. And so we're going to consider Jonathan this morning, some of the characteristics and things that we read about him in the book of 1 Samuel. So if you're there, you may be turning as we introduce our study to Jonathan. And as we look at this man whom I believe we would be benefited to imitate, you may be turning to 1 Samuel chapter 13 as we're going to begin our study about Jonathan there this morning. See, one of the things that we find out about Jonathan as we read his story, as it's recorded for us, Jonathan was a man that had a deep faith and a deep trust in God. And I believe that's revealed to us here as we read about him in 1 Samuel 13 and again in 1 Samuel 14. Chapter 13 kind of sets up and brings us to where we find ourselves in 14, where we'll see Jonathan's faith in action. But chapter 13 really gives us an appreciation for the faith and the things that he does. So let's look in chapter 13, verse 5, and let's read this passage. We see the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Bethaven. Now previously, just a few verses, what provoked this Philistine attack against the nation of Israel was Jonathan. You go back in verse 3 and you read, Jonathan and his men had attacked this garrison of the Philistines. And the army gets wind of it, the Philistines get wind of it. And so what they do, they take this as a threat of war. They gather their army together and they prepare to go to war with Israel. And at their disposal, did you notice, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and an innumerable army. Now that may not seem like a lot to us, but let's look at Israel's situation. And I gained some appreciation for what Jonathan is going to do in chapter 14. In chapter 13 still, though, look at Israel's situation. Beginning in verse 19, we read, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for sharpening a pin for a plowshare, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came to pass on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. So what we find out is that there was not a blacksmith in the land of Israel. There was no weapon maker. There was no one to work their iron and their bronze for farming implements. And more importantly, in this particular instance, there was no one to provide them with weaponry to defend themselves against their enemies. And so normally what they would have done is went down to the Philistines and they would have made use of their blacksmith. And so we find the Philistines who've got 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and an innumerable army, and you've got Israel, a bunch of people who are bumbling around without any weaponry. That's where we find Jonathan in 1 Samuel chapter 14. Now let's read about Jonathan's faith as he proceeds to act on his faith in God. In verse 6 of chapter 14, we'll pick up our story. You kind of see there the dire circumstance the Israelites are in. But let's look at Jonathan and his perspective on things, his outlook on things in chapter 14. Beginning in verse 6, we read, Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, go then. Here I am with you according to your heart. Then Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. And if they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up to them. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of Philistines, and the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden. The men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will show you something. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. They fell before Jonathan. And as he came after them, his armor bearer killed them. The first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And so we find there Jonathan and his great faith in God. You go back and you read a little bit in chapter 13. We didn't look at this passage. But most of Israel realizes the dire straits that the nation is in. Most of the army has ran and has hidden in the land. That's why the Philistines said, look, they've come out of their holes. The Israelites were hiding from the Philistines and their great army. But as Jonathan approaches, he wasn't there hiding. And you can understand his reasoning. And it wasn't based off of his own ability to go to war. It wasn't based off of his own talent. Because yet, even then, he's only one man against a garrison, a great army of Philistines. But you see Jonathan's faith in God in verse 6 when he says, the Lord might work for us. Nothing restrains the Lord from saving, by many or by few. It may just be me and you, he says to his armor bearer, but if God's involved, who knows what can happen as a result of it. And you notice the effect that Jonathan's faith had on his armor bearer. His armor bearer wasn't trembling and terrified and didn't forsake him when the battle got hot. He says, after he sees Jonathan's faith, my heart's with you. I'll go with you. If you go to war and if you trust in God, I'm right there with you. And so Jonathan devises this plan. He says, we'll show ourselves to the Philistines, and if they say come up to us, then we'll know. We take that as a sign that God has given us victory against these our enemies. But if they say you will come to you, then we'll know not to go to war. We'll know that it's not our intention and it's not God's intention to go to war. So they show themselves to the Philistines. And did you notice his armor bearer? His armor bearer would be a young man. That's how he's described in this text. He wouldn't have been a man of war like Jonathan. He wouldn't have been a great fighter. He was simply probably a young man that would have simply carried Jonathan's armor and his sword and his weaponry so that if Jonathan needed it on occasion, he would have it there. Jonathan and his young armor bearer go up to the Philistines and they kill 20 of their soldiers. You see, Jonathan trusted in the Lord. Verse 12 tells us Jonathan trusted in God. And he realized not only was God going to give Israel victory right here in this moment that he's engaging in battle, but he was going to give the nation victory. You read verses 15 and 16, and you look at what Jonathan has started. Jonathan takes that first step. Jonathan attacks the Philistines. Jonathan trusts in God. In verse 15, we see the result of that spreading out. There was trembling in the camp in the field, and he's talking about among the Philistines. And among all the people, the garrisons and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was a multitude melting away. And they went here and there. So we see that God personally involved himself in the battle. After Jonathan's leap of faith, after Jonathan and his armor bearer attacked this garrison of the Philistines, then God begins to intervene. The earth begins to shake. And as Saul and his men look out, what he sees is the Philistines scattering in all directions out of fear of God. And what we find out in verse 23 of the chapter we just read, the Lord saved Israel that day. But where did it start? It started with a young man that had a deep trust and a deep faith in God. You know, there's some lessons for us to learn as we consider the faith that Jonathan demonstrated here in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And as we continue to look at him, you're going to see why I'm describing him as a man, another man, that had a heart like God had. What we find out as we look at Jonathan's faith is that sometimes for us, and let's bring this full circle back to me and you, sometimes the first step that we may have to take is the most difficult. Jonathan had the courage to step out. When all of Israel about him was running and hiding in caves and in holes, Jonathan looked at what needed to be done. He took that first step that led Israel to an eventual victory. Maybe you're like the nation of Israel. Maybe you're standing there on the precipice of battle, and you know what it is God wants you to do. He wants you to arm yourself. He wants you to gird yourself. He wants you to jump into the fray and start serving, go to war against his enemies. But you're afraid. You know what it takes. You know you need courage. Look at Jonathan's example. Take that first step. Plunge in. It may be the hardest one, but remember what Jonathan said. Nothing restrains the Lord by saving by many or by few. And it may be as you consider your circumstances that it seems like the odds are stacked against you. That you don't have a hope. That there's no way that you can succeed in what it is you know God wants you to do in serving Him. But remember what Jesus said. What's impossible for man is possible with God. Jonathan remembered that element. That when God is involved, nothing is out of my hands. Nothing is out of my potential to accomplish. Call to mind the words of Jonathan. Nothing restrains the hand of the Lord by saving, by many or by few. And let that instill you with boldness that you need to begin serving God despite the circumstances that you're dealing with. You see, what great faith does, great faith doesn't look at the troubles that surround it. Great faith looks toward God. That's what Jonathan did that day. He didn't look at the innumerable army that was around him. He looked at God and said, we can do this. If God wills, we can do this. And what you'll find out is you'll see that not only does great faith accomplish great things for you, but great faith inspires others. If you're there and you're struggling, and it's a challenge for you to do what you know you need to do in service to God, you can be sure that somebody's probably watching. You can be sure that someone is watching and someone knows that you're struggling. If they see you there in that place, they see you step out onto the ledge, they see you take that first step, put your faith in God, trust in Him to bring about the result that He wants, that can inspire them. Jonathan's faith inspired his young armor bearer to go up against all of these impossible odds. Who will your faith inspire? Would it inspire your spouse? Will it inspire your children, perhaps, that are watching? Will the faith that you demonstrate in God touch someone else's life and bring them courage so that they too might follow in your example of faith in service to God? This other man, after God's own heart, shows us what it means to trust in God, and He shows us what that can do in our life. And as you talk about Jonathan, as you read through his story in 1 Samuel, it's quite obvious Jonathan was a good friend. A little more background on the situation as it progresses. The reign of Saul has continued, and Saul has transgressed God's commands two times in particular in major ways. In one occasion, he offers this sacrifice that he is not in a place to offer. He's of the tribe of Benjamin, but yet he sees fit to step into the role of priest and offer this sacrifice to God. Secondly, he failed to destroy the Amalekites, in which God commanded him to do. He brought back their king. He brought back some of the goods of the land. He failed to follow the command of the Lord fully. And so God gives him a message. He goes to Saul and says, "The kingdom's been taken away from you. The Lord has sought for Himself a man after His own heart." David has stepped into the scene. He was the one in chapter 18, I believe, 17, that stepped up against Goliath. And it becomes obvious as David's popularity grows and as the hand of the Lord moves away from Saul and follows after David and his greatness and his deeds, that Saul begins to realize and understand that it's going to be David who was the man that was determined to sit on his throne. What we find out is we see this relationship of Jonathan and David develop. We see there in chapter 18 and verse 1 an apt description of the friendship that they possessed. It was a unique friendship. It was a close friendship. And you turn over there to 1 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 1. You see there the description of the writer describing the relationship that Jonathan and David had together. Their friendship. Look at how it's described. "When he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." The description of their relationship is described for us here in this verse. Now, I don't know a lot about knitting, but I've noticed something my mom has done through the years. And she used to knit in particular these little dish rags that we would then put to good use washing dishes after meals, me and my brothers and things like that. But you could not pull those things apart. It was a piece of yarn, and if you've seen yarn, yarn is flimsy, yarn is weak. But she would take and she would interweave that yarn and interconnect it literally hundreds of times in the shape of this rag. And you could take it, you could tug on that thing with all your might, and I'm telling you, you could not break it. You might could cut it in half, you might have to destroy it, but that's the only way you were going to do it. That is the product of knitting. And what we find out here, the relationship that David had with Jonathan was that their two souls were knit together. So much so that it says David and Jonathan, they loved each other as their own soul. You may be turning to chapter 20 as we find out more about their friendship. And so while their relationship flourishes, as their friendship grows, Saul's jealousy and Saul's anger toward David becomes greater. And it gets to a point where Saul makes an attempt on David's life. David's there, standing in his presence, and Saul realizes what's taking place. He takes a spear and he throws it at David. He tries to kill him. David's forced to leave Saul's presence. Jonathan says, "I'll talk to my dad. I'll try to find out what his true intentions are." I think it was rather obvious at this point. "But I'll find out if he's forgiven you. If maybe you can come back and come back to the castle and resume your previous position." And so what he was going to do, he's going to sit down and he's going to try to discuss this plan, as Saul would notice David's absence. And Jonathan was going to determine, based off Saul's reaction, if Saul truly had forgiven David, or rather if he still held this anger and this grudge against him. So let's pick up our reading in chapter 20, beginning in verse 25. As the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall, Jonathan arose and Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, surely something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean. And as it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to his son Jonathan, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either today or yesterday? So Jonathan answered Saul, saying, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he says, please let me go, for our brother has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own mother's shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established nor your kingdom. Now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? And then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. You talk about sticking your own neck out for somebody. Sticking your own neck out for a friend. So great was Jonathan's loyalty to David that he took a great risk. And you see right here Saul's response when Jonathan tries to go to bat for David and say, David hasn't done anything to you. And he's going to remind Saul on another account, you know, David, he stepped out on the battlefield when no one else would. He slew Goliath. He killed your enemy. What's he done to you? But we see here Saul's response and Saul's persistent anger at David because he realizes he has been rejected. David has been chosen. And even then, Jonathan in this moment sticks his neck out for his friend. He goes to David. He warns him Saul's intention is to kill him. He's in a position where he's got to choose between his dad, his father, or his best friend. Even though Saul's wrong, I can't imagine it would be an easy decision to choose someone else in favor of your own father. It must not have been an easy decision for Jonathan to do. But yet what we see Jonathan demonstrating is true friendship. Jonathan stood by what was right. Saul was in the wrong. And so Jonathan remained loyal to his friend. We turn to chapter 23 and verse 16 and we see a little more of their friendships. This is one of the last encounters that Jonathan and David have. But in chapter 23 and verse 16, in between all of this, David is on the run for his life. And as he's talking to Jonathan in the previous occasion, he says, I know Saul wants to kill me. It seems like between me, there's only a step between me and death. And he's describing Saul's persistent chase to try to take his life. Jonathan realizes the direness of his situation. Jonathan goes to David. David's here hiding in the woods in this particular occasion. Verse 16 of chapter 23, Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. You see there the friendship that these two share. He realizes that David was running for his life. I would imagine it'd be dangerous to go in to see David at this point in time. Saul wanted him dead. At one point in time earlier in the book, Saul had made a decree and he was ready to have Jonathan at that point in time put to death. Can't even fathom such a thing. But he was ready to have his son put to death. Don't you imagine if he found him consorting with his greatest enemy that he might have him taken and killed? Jonathan's risking his life, but he understands David's on the run. David needs encouragement. He's down. He's fearful. I can help him. And so despite risking his own life, he goes. And do you notice what it said he did? It said he strengthened him in the hand of God. You know, he didn't offer to him some word of encouragement based off of his own self. He says, you need God. God will take care of you. God will protect you. God has chosen you. And so he goes and he strengthens him and he encourages him. And what we find out about Jonathan's friendship, as we see him demonstrating true characteristics of friendship, his loyalty toward David never falters. But perhaps the greatest demonstration of this is recorded by David, the relationship that these two enjoyed. Saul and his sons are going to meet quite an unfortunate end. They're going to be slain in battle by the Philistines. David gets word that Jonathan and Saul have died. And he spoke here in response, and I think this demonstrates perhaps as well as anything, the relationship, the friendship that these two enjoyed that was so unique. As David is describing his care and compassion and love for Jonathan. And when we find out now that Jonathan had died, he says, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You've been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." Now you can imagine that some today have taken this and have twisted this into something perverse. But that is absolutely not what we see taking place here as David speaks these words. As he pours out in heart, his heart in sorrow after he finds out that Jonathan, this man who was knit to him, whose soul was knit to him and who he loved as his own soul, as he finds out that he'd been killed at the hands of the enemy, he expresses his love. And what this is an expression of such wonderful love. And can you imagine saying something like this about perhaps your best friend? What would your wife do? You wouldn't even want to think about that. But yet David, as he's speaking here, says the relationship, the love that they enjoyed together was so great, the friendship they had was so strong, that it surpassed the love that he had with his wife. This doesn't at all demean the love that David had for Michal, his wife, but what it does is it magnifies the love that he had for Jonathan, his friend. It's a reflection of their relationship. Their souls were knit together as one. Their friendship was strong. And Jonathan shows us in his life what it means to be a good friend. And there's some application for us as well. You see, a good friend shows unwavering loyalty, just as Jonathan did. But he shows unwavering loyalty only in the right. Let me ask you, if you had a friend who was living in sin, would you approach them? Would you say anything about them to the condition that they were living in? Some might say, well, if I'm going to be a loyal friend to that person, I'm going to let them enjoy their moment. I'm not going to bring them down. I'm not going to guilt them. I'm not going to make them feel bad. I'm going to overlook their fault. That's what some might say being a good friend would be in that situation. But let me tell you, that's not what a loyal friend would do. The reason that Jonathan stood with David was because David was in the right. David had done no wrong. And since David was in the right, Jonathan took his stand right there beside him. And a loyal friend might be required to say something to someone else that's hard for them to hear. But let me ask you, if you saw your friend in sin and you didn't say anything to him, what kind of friend would you be? You wouldn't be a friend that had their best spiritual interests in mind, would you? Rather, you'd be a friend that was emphasizing perhaps that physical relationship over that spiritual relationship. A good friend is going to show unwavering loyalty, and a good friend is going to bring us up when we're down. David was on the run for his life. He was the king of Israel. He'd been anointed, but the king of Israel was being forced to hide in caves and amongst the enemy. Jonathan seeks David out. He renews their covenant. He offers to him words of encouragement. Isn't that what good friends do? Good friends, when they see us down, whether it be physically or spiritually, they do what Jonathan did. They bring them up. They strengthen them in the hand of God. We remind them of God's love and of God's plan. We are God's hands in those moments to offer words of compassion and concern and encouragement. Good friends can learn from Jonathan to offer unwavering loyalty, to bring up those who are down. And just as a side note, let's not just look for friends that are loyal like Jonathan. Let's seek to become a friend like Jonathan was to David. And then lastly, regarding Jonathan, another man after God's own heart, Jonathan accepted the will of the Lord. And I believe as I studied this text, this impressed me more than anything else. More than stepping out to battle hundreds and hundreds of men, Jonathan's acceptance of God's will impressed me more than anything else, and I believe embodies a man after God's own heart. You go back to 1 Samuel chapter 13, and you look at verses 13 and 14. This is where the kingdom is actually removed from Saul. As Samuel comes to him after Saul's offered the sacrifice, Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he has commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought after himself, sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded. Get this. God was going to give the kingdom of Israel to Saul and his sons. He would have established him forever, Samuel says. Saul's disobedience led to God removing the crown from his family and giving it to someone else, giving it to David. He's taken the throne from Saul. He's given it to David. Foolishly, Saul is going to wrestle what God has taken from him and give to his own son. But what about Jonathan? How do you think Jonathan might have seen things in this event here? He's gone from being the prince of Israel to nothing more than the shunned son of a king that God has removed from the throne, whose glory he's taken away. You think if you were in that position, you might blame David? Despite the fact that David hadn't done any wrong, might you blame David as the source of your father's rejection? I might have. Maybe you're jealous toward David because he's going to sit on the throne that you rightfully should have sat on as son of the king. Maybe you do like Saul does. Maybe you try to kill David. Maybe you try to wrestle what God has taken away into your own hands. What we see Jonathan doing is none of those things. We see Jonathan accepting the will of God. And this can't be seen any more clearly than in the following passages. In chapter 18, verses 3 and 4, look at what Jonathan does here. And on the surface, this may not make a lot of sense to us, but once you realize Jonathan's purpose in doing this, I think it becomes more clear as you look at it. Chapter 18, verses 3 and 4, Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan took off the robe that was on him, and he gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword, with his bow and his belt. This might seem odd, and you may think, well, because of their friendship, that's why Jonathan gave him his clothes and his armor and his weapon. But it was more than that. The prince would have worn special garb. He would not have worn clothes that commoners would have worn. He would have had royal garments. He would have had the finest weapons. He takes those clothes. He takes that garb. He gives it to David. He takes those weapons, his bow, his sword, his belt. He gives it to David. Clothing that the prince should have worn, the one who was going to reign after Saul died, he gives those to David. What do you think that symbolizes? He's stepping down from his role as crown prince. And by giving that to David, he is recognizing and acknowledging David's right to rule. You and I can't imagine what it'd be like to be royalty, to possess that right to rule. And you see the sinful pride that brought Saul to possess, being in that position. Jonathan, who should have been prince of all of Israel, steps down from that, gives that up, transfers that to David. With the transferring of his royal clothes, he transfers his right to rule. It kind of reminds me of a passage of Jesus in Philippians 2, verses 5 through 8, where we see that Jesus didn't place equality with God as something that should be grasped, but rather Jesus stepped down from the throne of heaven. He clothed himself with flesh, and he lived as a man. What Jonathan is doing here, I think in a very, very small degree, demonstrates the humility that Jesus had when he took on the flesh of man. When we see Jonathan removing himself from this position of prominence, transferring it willingly to another. And in verse 23, verses 16 and 17, this to me stood out above all others. Chapter 23, verses 16 and 17, is Jonathan's acceptance of the will of God. Read with me those two verses, if you will. This was the account we read previously where Jonathan arose, went to David in the woods, and strengthened his hand in God. But look at what he says in verse 17. He said to him, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." So what you see here is a young man who recognized God's will. David didn't have to come to Jonathan and say, "Hey, buddy, I've been anointed as king. God's chosen me." Jonathan had discerned that on his own. He didn't have to ask Jonathan to step aside. Jonathan had witnessed the kingdom as it was stripped away from his father. He'd seen the hand of the Lord shift from Saul to David. He was able to discern what God's will was in this matter. And rather than responding in jealousy and anger, he voluntarily steps down. If I were Jonathan, I might would have had to leave when David began to rule. When David became king, because the thought would have never left my mind. That should be my throne. That should be me sitting there. That should be me ruling. I'm not even going to stand in his way, but I'm going to leave. Being in the presence of David would be a reminder of everything, I believe, for Jonathan that he had lost. Let me see if I can help you relate to what Jonathan is doing perhaps a little more. Think of it like this. Suppose that you are engaged to someone. Your best friend comes along and your fiance leaves you for your best friend and marries them, the person that you were going to spend the rest of your life with. Maybe, just maybe, you can forgive them. But could you ever bear to be in their presence? To see the happiness and the joy that they enjoyed, would that not daily be a reminder for what you had with that person when they left you and they gave up that pleasure with you for someone else? Could you step into that role of third wheel and befriend both of them, knowing that their joy came at a cost and a sacrifice to you? I can't imagine how jealousy would not keep that person in a constant rage. Yet that's exactly what we see Jonathan doing in 1 Samuel chapter 23, where he said to David, "You shall be king over Israel. And I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to forsake you. I'm going to be right there beside you." He'd accepted God's will that David reign as king in his spot to the degree that he was willing to step aside. But not only that, it was Jonathan's full intention to stand there beside David when he reigned as king and lend him his support. Some lessons for you and I as we bring our lesson to a close. God's will in my life might not always be something that's easy to accept. I believe Jonathan makes that look easy. But the reality is, as I consider what God wants me to do, it's not always going to come so easy. Jesus described our life as carrying a cross in Matthew chapter 10. Let each person take up his cross and follow me. It's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be something that brings us joy. Maybe you're here, you're dealing with a marriage that's testing your resolve. Yet you know what God says about marriage. God says that you are committed to this person for life. You know that's God's will. And it may not be easy to accept. It might be easier to remove yourself from that relationship. But will you do, and will you accept what is the will of God? Or maybe your health is failing you, and as you're dealing with those challenges, you've got this opportunity to draw closer to God. Will you do that? Because you know that James says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials? Or will you push God away? Do like Job's wife encouraged him to do and turn your back against God, blaming him for those things. If your faith requires you to make sacrifices, and the Bible, the New Testament reveals that it does, would you do that? Would you willingly give those things up because you know that's what God would have you do? It might not always be easy, but it is something that we should do. I may have to stand aside for someone else, and I think that's what we see here with Jonathan. The humility that he demonstrated in stepping aside for God's plan and God's will, that may be something we need to do in our life. Perhaps it's putting the will of our spouse over our own desire. You know, we've got our own desire. Maybe we even have a right to do something. But will we put the need and the desire of our spouse over our own desire? Will we step aside as Jonathan did? Or maybe it's your brother who you have this right to do something or another, but you know it's going to bother them. You know it's going to offend them. Would you step aside for your brother and accept the will of the Lord and make those necessary sacrifices? I would have liked to have known how Jonathan's life might have further played out. But due to his father's rejection of God and his insistence that he rule on the throne, Jonathan lost his life in a battle with Saul and his other sons. But as I read his story, I find there an absence of anything negative. And that says a lot to me. What we learn as we read from Jonathan is we see his great faith in God, the deep faith that he had. And what we see is what it means to truly be a good friend. And what we see when we read Jonathan is we learn what it means to possess humility and to appreciate and accept the will of God. And it's unfortunate that this man's life was cut so short. I would have loved to read the rest of his story. The disobedience of his father brought his life, however, to a sudden close. And that is a reminder for us We don't always have tomorrow. We don't always have that time to prepare. And so if you're here this morning and if you know what it is God would have you to do, and you need to take that step, or if you've been contemplating that, you can do that this morning. Jonathan's life, snuffed out in its youth, was a reminder that we don't always have that opportunity to get ready. It was Jonathan's intention to rule beside David. But for him, that day never came. He lost his life in battle, and it was brought to an abrupt end. And if you're waiting for tomorrow this morning, there's no guarantee that you're going to have that. So if you have changes that you need to make, I would encourage you to do that today. Or perhaps, as you consider Jonathan's life and everything that he demonstrated, faith and friendship and love and humility, you realize you need to take on some of those things as well. Won't you make that decision and that commitment to give up, to step aside, to humble yourself and make those changes that you need to make? If anyone's here this morning and needs to respond to the invitation, and anyone, we would encourage you to do so as we stand and as we sing the song of invitation.